Our author takes us to Chanel's Riviera. It is hard today to compare a scene that prevailed then with now. It was unique when one considers how the celebrities of that era seemed unaware, unable to fear a threat of war in their self-contained oasis. And enough. I know my role, my happy place is to introduce her now and foresee the fascinating stories from Anne de Courcy.
Does this one work all right? Can you hear me? Yes? Oh, this one, you think. All right. Well, I'm afraid after the last wonderful speech we had, I'm going to lower the tone a bit. Because not for nothing did Somerset Maugham describe the Riviera as a sunny place for shady people. Like that? Good, sorry. Well, as I said, not for nothing did Somerset Maugham describe the Riviera as a sunny place for shady people. Now, the first thing, if you write a book, people practically always ask you is, why did you pick that subject? In my case, it was because I was fascinated by Chanel and almost as fascinated by the Riviera. So first, Chanel. It was amazing how this woman, who was born the illegitimate daughter of a poor market trader, overcame being an orphan, stuck in an orphanage for six solid years, and being, shortly after that, a kept woman, to rise to the height of being perhaps the best-known couturier in the world, feted by everybody, friends with the rich and famous, and a multimillionaireess. She was orphaned at 11. Her father stuck her and her sister straight away into the orphanage, disappeared, was never seen again, and for 6 years she was in this abbey, Aubazine, where everything was black and white, from the nuns' habits to the school children's skirts and blouses. She did learn to sew there, which was lucky, because after the orphanage, she was apprenticed to a tailor, a military tailor, and the young officers from nearby came and had their uniforms altered or their epaulets sewn on or whatever, and they quickly noticed these pretty girls in the back room, and she went off to live with one. But even then, she was only his second-string mistress. He was keeping a famous cocotte. So she spent most of her time in the stables, where she learnt to hunt, which came in very useful later. And she then fell in love with somebody she met there, who was another playboy, but unusually for a playboy. He was English, actually. He had a very strong work ethic. And he also believed that women could really do anything they set their minds at. They were not, as most of them were in those days, adjunct to some man. So he subsidized her, he set her up. Her ideas were always original. People used to come up to her and say, will you make me a hat like that? Hers were plain instead of the usual enormous sweeping ones with feathers and flowers. And pretty quickly, she did very well. But what really made her money was her scent. It was a time when smart women, nice women, I should say, rather than smart, used to wear only flower scents, and these didn't last. You either had to drench yourself in it so that the whole room would have smelt of gardenia, or people didn't think you were wearing scent. Well, she thought she wanted to take a leaf out of the book of, in fact, of the cocottes who wore wonderful sensual scents that lasted. Only she didn't put it quite like that, of course. She met through one of her lovers, the Grand Duke Dmitri, who had been one of the people instrumental in murdering Rasputin. She met through him a famous perfumer and asked him to bring her some samples. And he brought her 10. And when they got to number 5, she said, c'est ça. And Chanel number 5 was born. She believed strongly in scent. She used to say, put it wherever you want to be kissed, which I think leaves quite a lot of doors ajar. And when she settled on the Riviera, she spent all her summers there from 1930 to 1944. That's why I've got those dates on my book. She was coming to the end of a long drawn-out affair with Ben Dorr, the Duke of Westminster, the richest man in England. He took a long time getting her. She was pretty elusive at first, but she finally succumbed. She became his hostess. She learned to salmon fish. She could already ride very well and hunt. She became a great friend of Winston Churchill. She decorated his houses, including his house in Scotland. And I may say she introduced the first B-Day to Scotland, which I call a real cultural landmark. And so she then built this, or rather converted this villa there. Well, now, there were quite a number of villas on the Riviera. It had only been opened up at the end of the 1920s by the Murphys and Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway and people. But now the big hotels were staying open. It was the absolute heyday of the Riviera. Maharajas, film stars, actors, aristocracy, in fact, anybody who could afford it came there. It was the playground of Europe, and people loved it. But I have to say, a lot of them behaved nohow. H.G. Wells, for instance, who was devoted to paterfamilias at home. He had a wife and children at home, but he also built a love nest on the Riviera for his succession of mistresses, sometimes two simultaneously, but not in the same house, of course. Somerset Maugham had a lovely villa there. Lord Rothermere had a villa where he kept his wonderful collection of paintings and his string of mistresses. He always used to say that old mistresses were much more expensive than old masters. Maxine Elliott, the actress, had the Villa de l'Horizon, where Churchill used to come and stay and paint. And this gilded life. Oh, and another person who had a villa there was one of the most successful writers of the time, E. Phillips Oppenheim, always known as Oppie. And he, too, didn't behave very well. His yacht was known as the Floating Double Bed, and I leave you to guess why. This gilded life went on more or less through the 30s. There was, of course, thunderclouds gathering. There was Hitler doing more and more things like that, but nobody took any notice, least of all the Windsors, who were living there from 1936 onwards in the Chateau de la Croix. They were leading as near a regal life as they could manage. Their villa was done up, even, in Buckingham Palace colours, red, white, and gold. And you had to curtsy to the Duke and Duchess night and morning. And the Duke's secretary, she had to stand while she was taking dictation, which I think must have been awful. Anyway, as I say, nobody took any notice. They didn't even really take any notice when war was declared. The Duke's reaction when he heard that war had been declared was to come out, tell his party, oh, war's been declared, and dive into the swimming pool. The French all said, it'll be over by Christmas. It was called la drôle de guerre, the phony war. And they said, anyway, we have the Maginot Line, which was deemed impregnable. And it really was impregnable, actually. Generals used to come from all around the world to look at it. And nobody knew that the Germans would just go round it. So then France was divided into two, occupied and non-occupied. Le Nono region, the non-occupied one, was known as. And that should have been fairly free for them. But the awful thing was, which I hadn't realized before, Pétain could easily have been a Nazi. He introduced all these draconian Nuremberg-type laws really aimed at eradicating the Jews. Many of them had come to the south of France. They thought they would be safe there. In fact, Cannes was known as Cannes-on-Sea at one point. There were so many. And no, Pétain and Laval together deprived them of their livelihoods. I can't describe to you how badly they behaved. Well, now, researching all this, as you can imagine, was fascinating, but at times absolutely heartrending. I went to Israel to look up the Jewish refugee stories, which were tragic. And I was lucky enough to get hold of a lot of diaries and contemporary stuff, because I always believe you should use contemporary documentation whenever you can. It brings life to books. And also, the memories of the descendants of the people who lived there, the children and the grandchildren. Well, they were able to tell me some things that I never would otherwise have known. Like, for instance, when the Germans were in possession of the Riviera, the peasants, if the Germans were coming to their village, would cut off all the tops of the potatoes. Otherwise, the Germans would dig them up and take them, because practically all the food was siphoned off to Germany. They were all starving. Women, pregnant women, were allowed to go to the head of ration queues, which often gave out halfway, so that was a very desirable privilege. So a lot of women used to stuff cushions under their dresses, so the habit of prodding a pregnant woman in the stomach took over, just to see that she was genuine. Otherwise, there was an outcry and she was sent to the back. Another thing I was told is how the resistance workers in the hills, the resistance movement strengthened, obviously, as the war swung against the Germans. They would send little black coffins to collaborators as a warning of what was going to happen to them. And all the cats on the Riviera disappeared. They were sold as rabbit on the black market. And the other funny little thing I heard was that there was a huge ostrich farm on the Riviera because the climate was so good for ostriches. It produced absolutely the right plumage. And this was used for the derrières of the girls who danced in the Folies Bergères. And on that rather frivolous note, I think I'll sit down.